Welcome to episode 132 of the Star Trek Academy podcast. Today, we're all about the Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode Janal. I'm the Academy Philosophy Professor, Rodney Cupp.
And I'm the Academy Media Professor, Michael Merrick. We'll begin with a brief summary of the episode. So if you're not listening right in the week after the episode premieres, you can refresh your memory. And with that summary brimming with spoilers, here's Dr. Rodney Cupp.
Markings on that metal object they found on Lyric in that last episode match the facial spots of a Trill who was the host of Janal centuries ago. They find Janal's current host on Trill and transfer his consciousness to Kolber so he can lead them to the next clue. They encounter dangerous life forms on a hike to the clue's location. Janal surrenders the clue to Burnham and Book only after they connect peacefully and respectfully with the life forms. Adira is a member of the away team, but they remain in the caves of Makala where Gray breaks up with them. Burnham tells Raynor to meet in person with the crew while they're away. He doesn't think it's necessary since he's studied their files, and he's busy looking for Mole and Locke anyway, so he gives each of them 20 words to tell him something he doesn't already know about them. Tilly tells him that he won't gain the respect of the crew if he doesn't connect with them. Meanwhile, Saru tries to delay the announcement of his engagement to Tarina after he learns that the Vulcan purists won't be happy about it. But Tarina makes it clear to him that she doesn't need a caretaker. And at the end of this episode, Mol, disguised as a Trill, attaches something to Adira's jacket.
Now, to guess, do you think maybe it's a tracking device?
I was saying tracking device or maybe a bug, something like that.
Yeah, we will see.
Anyway, before we explore the philosophy and the themes and the morals in the episode, we're going to take a look at some production details here.
And Rodney, this episode has a fairly standard structure for Star Trek. We often talk about the A-B story structure, and this episode really has, I think, three subplots. If you will, the A story is the Trill, Janal, and Seeking Clues story, and that does include, kind of off to the side, the Adira and Gray relationship. The B story, you could say, is the Tilly and Raynor story, and then the C story is the Saru and Tarina subplot. And, you know, they can do these multiple subplots, I think, because, well, this episode is about 55 and a half minutes long, which is considerably longer than the typical network TV episode these days, which is maybe 41 or 42 minutes long. And Star Trek today often does nudge up against close to an hour, not counting commercials if you happen to be on a plan that includes commercials. But that just gives them more time to enrich the story, which in this case means three subplots that interact back and forth.
You know, some fans want more than 10 episodes per season, but these episodes are longer.
In this story, we learn more about the search for the progenitor tech. It began way back during the Dominion War, which, of course, went bad. That war went badly for the Federation for a long time. So maybe it's not surprising that Starfleet at that time commissioned a search for this technology that at least could possibly be weaponized. Now, that time frame is a little earlier than I calculated last time. But I did say that 800 years put it around the time of Star Trek Picard, and the Dominion War was 20, 25 years before that. And if this search took 20 or 25 years to actually find the tech, which is probably not at all impossible, then the times do fit in together pretty well. So Janal was part of that search, and the group as a whole did find this tech, but one of them was killed trying to activate it, so they hid it away, but they left kind of a safety valve so that someone worthy could find it during a time of peace following this series of clues that they had left behind. On the other hand, Starfleet still clearly knew that there had been a search and that somewhere out there there were clues, and I think Starfleet was on the lookout for clues as to how to find this tech, which is why they issued the Red Directive when the wreckage of Velik's ship was found by their probe.
Yeah, and you might remember in an earlier podcast I was wondering, this tech is so dangerous, why would they leave a trail? Well, I think finally, we're explicitly told why Janal and the rest of them left a trail Stamets has discovered somehow that it could be used to do good. He says it could be used to design new life forms, accelerate evolution, modify ecosystems, and maybe even reanimate dead organisms. And so there are worries here about Frankenstein and a Genesis device. I know that. But he says that in the right hands, this tech could do immense good. So Jinal and the rest of them had to make sure that Burnham and Starfleet were worthy.
You know, I was wondering what would happen to the plan that was established 800 years ago. What if somebody passed the test of Jinal's beasties, but there are obviously going to be future steps, future clues. What if this hypothetical party passed the Jinal beastie test, but failed a future test?
Yeah, and these tests are dangerous. You know, they could have been killed.
Mm-hmm. So now there are two pieces of the puzzle that are not available to some future potentially worthy seekers. And so if Burnham and Discovery fail to find a future clue, do not find the progenitor tech, nobody ever will, unless Discovery would somehow manage to go back and return these pieces of the puzzle to Trill and Lyric. And Jinal will not be there to vet future seekers because the symbiont has apparently gone on. So the stakes are high if Burnham and Discovery fail. Could mean no one anytime in the future would ever find this technology. Anyway, it's a linchpin of this worthiness plan that Jinal personally gets to talk with the candidates and vet them by testing how they respond to these creatures on Trill. In other words, how they respond to meeting a completely unfamiliar species. And it looks like finding the remaining clues will also each be a further test of worthiness. And remember the first clue last time, finding the fifth stanza of the poem, that was also a test of cultural understanding, a test of worthiness also last time. The preliminary question to Burnham about where the fourth points was just essentially, I think, to validate that the searchers had been on Rilic and had read the poem. And I was wondering, what if it turns out to be a musical lyric, given that the planet's name is Lyric? Wouldn't it be cool if the preservers from the Paradise Syndrome were still around in this progenitor's story arc? Because remember, they communicated by music.
I did not remember that, but...
but well, you remember Kirk and Amnesia and the giant obelisk that moves? Yeah, and Spock decoded it by understanding that these symbols were musical notation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it possible that the preservers and the progenitors may be related or even identical?
I don't know. The preservers were maybe 10,000 years ago because remember they were moving Native American species to other planets and that kind of thing. So if they are the progenitors, then the progenitors have been around for billions of years, which is not impossible to a very advanced species. We don't know. Some other quick takes, and these are in no particular order, so they may flop around a little bit, but did it seem that having these giant invisible creatures on a civilized Federation planet was just a little bit strange? Of course, you know, we want to preserve endangered species, and I'm guessing that this valley that they were in maybe is some kind of preserve, a little bit like maybe Vulcan's Forge is, where they have some big and belligerent critters. But, you know, you wouldn't want these giant invisible fire-breathing whatever they are to be flying around cities and nesting in cities and things. But they may be intelligent, though. They're at least intelligent enough to recognize phasers, because when Burnham and Book put away the phasers, the beasties were willing to negotiate.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe the people of Trill, they've been very careful not to invade their habitat, so they can coexist.
Mm-hmm. So did the whole story about these critters remind you of the Horta in Devil in the Dark?
Yes. I mean, those eggs, Michael. And when I was going to mention this, those eggs among the rocks reminded me of the Horta's eggs. It was a quick connection for me.
And remember in Devil in the Dark, it was Spock who mind-melded with the Horta, made a psychic connection there. This time, Book did the same
thing. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's a very Star Trek-like plot twist, asking the question, how do we define a monster? Just because they look and act a little bit strange or even appear to be hostile doesn't mean they are when you understand them. I was kind of worried that this was going to be another over-the-top action sequence as they run around from the fire-breathing critters. In a way it was, but it was also an appropriate length, and I think it had a good outcome. So I do think it worked. Speaking of telepathic connections, we've never heard anything about Trills being telepathic, but it must have been some sort of telepathy that allowed transference of Janal's consciousness without using technology. Now, Alton Soong used technology to move consciousness, like from Picard's failing body into Picard's android body. But we've never heard about Trills having any kind of telepathic psychic ability in the past. If the Trill and a host are in the same body, well, there's a kind of a physical connection there. It doesn't have to be fully psychic, maybe. And, you know, I don't think Burnham should have been quite so surprised about meeting a previous host of Bix. Bix is the symbiote that was hosted by Janal in the past. Remember, in Season 3, she met all of Tal's previous hosts, you know, down in the pool, underwater.
That's
she
right.
met all of their hosts. So it was done in a different way this time. But she kind of seemed like she'd never imagined the possibility in this episode, in Janal's episode, and she'd done it before. I note the Discovery is still using the Spore Drive, even though the Spore Drive program has been shuttered in favor of some new system that we haven't learned much of anything about.
As we were reminded by Geordi, we don't throw something away just because it's old. Could still be useful.
It presumably still gets them there faster than some kind of other star drive. Although, again, we don't know anything about this pathway drive and how fast it goes and all that. We've heard a couple of notes now about the Breen becoming more dangerous, which certainly seems like it might be setting up for the future. But we may not get to it this season. We'll see. And, of course, Discovery is canceled, so we may not ever get to it. Or I'm wondering if it might show up in the Starfleet Academy series that's been announced and is down the road several months until it's ready to premiere. Tarina mentions all of Saru's years of living on Discovery. Did you note that? By my math, it's only three or four linear years, probably a year or so before they came to the future. And then seasons 3 and 4 of Discovery, and now season 5. So looks to me like it's somewhere around 3 or 4 years, which, of course, you know, I've lived in apartments less time than that, you know, when I was younger. But it's not like he's been there for a couple of decades.
Did you factor in the time he spent on Discovery while Burnham was in the Klink?
Well, yeah.
Oh,
but,
okay.
You know, from the time he got there till the time Discovery went to the future, I mean, we don't know, but I don't think that she was in the Klink, as you say, for a few years before,
no,
before
it wasn't that long.
Being hijacked for Discovery. So he's been there a while, and even 3 or 4 years in what's essentially an apartment, you know, quarters, moving on can be troublesome, or, you know, leave you with some emotional feelings.
Yeah.
Obo and Detmer are mentioned in this episode, but they're not seen on screen.
No.
And Nielsen has transferred to Voyager, so I'm wondering, I haven't seen anything in the media announcing what that's all about.
Yeah, and we've got Lieutenant Christopher here, and that means Bryce is gone. Is he still working with Kovich? I mean, there are a lot of new officers on the bridge now that we were introduced to them as Tilly introduces them to Rayner. I wonder if we're going to learn anything about them. Well, I guess we did learn some tidbits here, but
a few, a few. 20 words or less. I didn't pick it up the first time through when I watched, but when Reno is talking with Stamets about the Adira Gray relationship, she says, everything's got a half-life.
Mm-hmm.
And that comment is what caused Stamets to look at the half-lives of elements with respect to the old tricorder data, which got him all excited about finding solutions to some of their questions.
You know, I noticed that, Michael, and I didn't know what to make of it. And so I'm glad you said that. I did also pick up, speaking of half-lives, about the fact that Rayner says that Sluggo Cola looks radioactive. Now, that probably doesn't mean anything, but you probably noticed a Ferengi serves this cola to Tilly in the fourth act. It's Sluggo Cola. I just thought that was so cool because we saw an ad for Sluggo Cola last season in Lower Decks during that visit to Ferenginar. And I guess Sluggo Cola has been around at least since DS9. Is that right? I think so.
It hasn't very much called attention to itself in my consciousness, I'm afraid to say. I was wondering, does Gray have a symbiont? Gray is certainly training in the Trill community, but remember that Gray has an android body and is no longer connected to the Tal symbiont that is now in Adira. And I don't recall whether we've heard that Gray has a symbiont here in Gray's android body. These android bodies, of course, are made from organic material, and they're very difficult to differentiate from non-androids. So it might be feasible, but of course we know not everybody is capable or suitable for hosting a Trill symbiont.
That's true, right? Most Trill are not symbionts. They don't have hosts. I don't think we've heard that Gray has a symbiont, so I guess I just assumed that he doesn't.
And that may be true, but still, Gray is working in this community, like as an initiate or a trainee for maybe the monastic role of caring for the symbionts. So I was just interested in see if we will learn any more about that. I'm with Janal about liking the new Starfleet uniforms.
Oh, yeah?
Except for, whatever you call it, the jacket or the tunic or the outer blouse, whatever it's called, being different lengths on each side. That is a fashion choice I just don't get. I don't know where it came from, either in the continuity of the Star Trek universe or in the continuity of the costume designers working on Discovery. In addition to the quick image in a promo that we talked about last podcast, we have another mention this time around of the 23rd century Constitution class starship design, this one from Reese. Mm-hmm. And so again, that seems like it's something they're setting up for the future.
Yeah, good point. Good point.
And finally, in this part of the podcast, Rodney, I saw something online and looked into it, and I'm wondering if this is coincidental or intentional. The names Maul and Locke, always spoken of in that order, are pronounced the same as the name Moloch, which appears in the Old Testament and has historically at least been understood to be a Canaanite god long ago, known for demanding sacrifice of children. More figuratively, Moloch can be a name applied to like any power that demands large or dire sacrifices.
Wow, so this could be some sort of foreshadowing here, maybe. And you remember how Fred, right, made such a big deal about their names. The writers definitely wanted us to take notice of those names. So I bet you're onto something here, Michael.
It's never Locke and Maul. It's always Maul and Locke.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it hardly seems like these character names could be a coincidence. And, you know, in fiction, it's not unusual that a character's name says something symbolically about the character.
No, not at all.
But I'm not seeing what the symbolism of Maul and Locke might be here in Discovery. I'm not seeing anything that would reveal that yet.
No, I imagine we'll be learning much more about them, and then maybe it'll become evident, but I'm not seeing it either. But this is great. This is something for us to keep an eye on.
To watch for, yeah.
Yeah. Well, at this point, we're going to talk about meaning in this episode. We're looking for messages that the writers and producers might have wanted to provide us, and also for any lessons we might have found, regardless of the intent of those writers and producers. We know that this is serialized storytelling, as Discovery has always been. So lessons may not become evident until later in the season. But so far, Michael, we've been pretty successful at finding themes, morals, and the like in all the episodes we see.
And Rodney, I think this time there's a very clear theme and lesson as a takeaway, that being making connections.
That's Gray, it.
Gray's final speech about every life being a journey and the importance of connection and of choosing, making the choice to make connections with those we encounter.
Yeah, and that's one bookend for the episode, Gray's sort of sermon almost maybe at the end, because in the teaser, when Reno is talking to Stamets about Adira, Reno says, everyone's on a journey. We come together, we come apart. And these two things bookend the episode with that theme.
And furthermore, the Tilly and Rainer subplot is certainly about making connection, about making it a two-way street. Culber hosting the consciousness of Jinal. It takes a physical connection, almost a laying on of hands, to make that transference of consciousness, understanding the giant invisible beasties through book's ability is making a connection that, remember, the creatures first declined it, but later when the phasers were gotten out of the way, kind of as an offering of goodwill, the critters accepted.
Right, and those two things that you just mentioned there about Tilly and Raynor learning something about how connection works and what it's good for, and of course Book and Burnham making a connection with these beasts, if you want to call them that, it's not just connection, it's also respect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tilly tells Raynor that he has to earn the respect of his crew. Book and Burnham show respect to these creatures by apologizing for invading, you know, their nesting area. So I think respect is also an important component here.
Yeah, I mean, I think hypothetically you could probably have a connection for negative reasons. I hate that guy so much. But certainly in this episode, it's about the positive connections,
mm-hmm.
positive and beneficial connections. But there are more elements of this theme here, exploring the relationship between Saru and Tarina. It's about defining how their connection will work. And, of course, Adira and Gray change the nature of their relationship, but they promise to continue their connection. I'll always be there for you.
Yeah.
And finally, I note earlier in the episode, we're told that connection is a choice. Again, and I mentioned that earlier, you make the choice to make the connection with people we meet along the way.
So just to quickly note, the question about Raynor this season is going to be, will he make that choice, right?
Mm-hmm. And was he really this way on his previous ship? I don't think he was this way on his previous ship. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, but I think he is compensating for essentially being disciplined.
Mm.
Speaking of connections and relationships, Tarina, in her relationship with Saru, is kind of taking a feminine stance here as she asserts that she knows what's best for herself and does not need caretakers. In effect, they didn't use the word, but she doesn't need mansplainers about what's good for her.
Yeah, basically asking for some kind of respect here, right? And I love it, you know, in that one scene, it turns out that although her employee is very good at politics, it turns out that Tarina's better than both of them, right? She's looking at this whole political situation at a far deeper level than they are.
Yeah, yeah. So we talked about that. I want to step back to Raynor for a second, his character. Yeah, he's clearly been created as the Captain Jellicoe of Discovery, right? Brusque and directive and aloof. And I am sure that his character development arc will focus on this theme of connections that Tilly established for him. But, you know, his character, as it's been created, draws on really a stereotype about what commanding officers are like. And the reality is that any commanding officer has to be interested in people and value them and engage with them. I saw a recommendation from one military commander that the best advice for a new commander is to send handwritten notes frequently commending success and saying thank you.
Hmm.
A successful commander makes subordinates want to be supportive because they like the commander and they feel listened to and valued, so much so that if the occasion comes up that the commander just has to make a snap decision, maybe one we don't even like, we'll still go along because we've established a high level of two-way respect.
Hmm.
In the Raynor subplot, Tilly is the mouthpiece for this need on the part of commanders. And remember that she's teaching leadership at Starfleet Academy. Presumably that's a big part of what cadets learn at Starfleet Academy. It's not just about the mechanics of running a starship. It's about how to be an officer, how to be a leader. And I think that she understands correctly that Raynor is compensating for his own feelings of failure, and he's going through the motions rather than seeking out those connections. It seems he is considering her critique, not just brushing it off.
Yeah,
but I think what's going on here is he knows that the crew knows why he's there. And he understands that in the eyes of the crew, his reputation is kind of muddy. And opening up to that kind of situation, to that kind of rebuff, that kind of criticism, can be risky emotionally. So I think that's what's going on with him. And, yeah, I think there will be a character growth arc here. Another thing that I've been thinking about here, we hear a lot about Vulcan purists in this episode. You know, maybe what a long time ago used to be called logic extremists, but now it's Vulcan purists, a faction that is presumably related to the Vulcan discipline of logic. And I have to admit, the idea of politics in Vulcan society seems strange to me. Politics implies factions and disagreements about what the best path forward is. If logical analysis is really a deep thing culturally for Vulcans, the logic shouldn't be different for different people. They should be able to agree on what is the best logic. And the fact that politics exists indicates that emotions are often superseding logic. So that was my first reaction. But we have to remember that Vulcan is now Nivar. Vulcan is not Vulcan anymore. And we have a society blending those who remained on Vulcan and follow the ways of logic and those for whom emotions are welcome and expressed overtly, the Romulan faction that came back to the planet. We talked on our last podcast about how emotions, well controlled, assist logic, inform logic, and help us find the best solutions to questions or problems, because our emotions are what tells us that something is desirable or not so desirable. The problem in society today is that for many people, emotions and logic are not in good balance, leading to things like road rage and school shootings and all kinds of unsocial things, and for that matter, things that block connections. And a lot of elements in our society seem to promote and normalize losing control of our emotions. We had hints in past Discovery that those of the Vulcan and Romulan heritages are trying to find common ground with each other, but the Vulcan purists are presumably those who find the inclusion of emotions to be undesirable. I suspect that it's easier for those who willingly express emotions to control them than for those who champion logic to allow overt emotions to influence them.
I have some thoughts here, Michael. You know, if these Vulcan purists are the 32nd century's Vulcan logic extremists, I just remember back in season one of Discovery how they didn't take too well to Sarek having a human wife, a human foster daughter.
They tried to kill him.
Yeah, and I guess that's what's happening here. You know, these people, they don't like Tarina, you know, being with a Kelpian. And there's something irrational about that kind of bigotry, obviously.
I want to talk about something going a little bit different direction here, and we hinted on it earlier, but in this episode, Stamets helps define the threat of the progenitor's technology falling into the wrong hands. Yeah, there's that ability to create new life and accelerate evolution and change ecosystems, and I think there are big questions, ethical questions about all of those, but
sure.
Stamets includes the possibility of reanimating dead organisms. Imagine a war in which soldiers killed could be brought back to life and sent out to fight again. Sounds like a video game. On the other hand, imagine being able to create practical immortality. There are plenty of science fiction stories out there where immortality has been achieved, but for example, it's reserved for the ruling class, not offered to everybody. If all intelligent species on all worlds were actually offered universal immortality and they all accepted the offer, the galaxy would fill up pretty fast.
Yeah.
And some of the stories about immortality suggest that after a century or two, you'd get pretty bored. Again, like we noted last podcast, it wouldn't surprise me if there's a major plot twist and the progenitor tech is completely different than what we're expecting. And that may be the last episode or so of the season that we find that out.
Well, how about let's move on to some final thoughts here, Michael. I've got a few.
Good, because I don't have many. Let me just get mine out of the way here quick. We are clearly in this storytelling mode using incremental progress of the plot episode by episode. And that is the Discovery context, the way they've always done it. And it's fine that they're doing it this season. Even the producers and the actors call it hyper-serialization of the story. And in past seasons, this technique has sometimes made us a little bit weary, the most common example being taking an entire episode to transit the galactic barrier, last season of Discovery. But I think the question about using this approach is, does the plot make enough progress in each episode? Is the overall pacing of the season good? And I think so far, three episodes in, I think this Discovery season is pacing well. The story of the episode and the subplots are advancing, and in this particular episode, it worked for me well. And this episode has a lot stronger lesson learned message than I kind of expected this early in a serialized season. And it was a good message, so I think it was a good episode.
Yeah, no, I liked it too, and I found myself spending more maybe time than usual thinking about this episode. I sometimes, actually quite often, I prefer drama Star Trek more than action adventure Star Trek. I'm finding that out now. I mean, as an adult, as a child, it was the action adventure stuff that appealed to me, but not so much anymore. One thing about this episode and its message, and I don't know how you're going to react to this, Michael, but the theme yet again is connection. How many times have you and I sat here talking about an episode of Star Trek saying that the theme is connection?
Or talk about very related themes like family and found family. So it is, a long-term theme that crosses all of the current Star Trek series, really.
And I guess if I had a beef about it, and like I said, it's not as if I didn't like this episode, but there are other themes to explore, and I worry that, we're beating a dead horse here. I'm not saying it's a bad message. It's an interesting episode. I liked it. But, there are a lot of other themes you can explore in Star Trek, I think. Connection is one of them, but there are others. It's feeling to me at least it's getting a little stale, if you don't mind my saying.
Over the years, over the decades, Star Trek has often picked a social issue and addressed it through the story of the episode, often translating the issue onto a different planet or something like that. And when we were doing episodic Star Trek, we could cover a whole bunch of social issues over the course of a season. If we have a single continuous story arc, it's hard to address a whole bunch of things. So, if I was in the writer's room trying to figure out what are we going to do with this upcoming season, maybe you look for something overarching. Looking at social issues today, you could say, what are common social issues today? Still racism, nationalism, angst about immigration, abortion policy, a whole bunch of these things you could define as fitting under the overarching theme of connections. And what happens if your connections with others are good? And what happens if your connections with others are not good? Mm-hmm. And, if I was in the writer's room trying to figure this out, it might well be that I would pick an overarching theme to address in as many different ways as possible, as opposed to here are 20 different social issues to address one at a time.
Yeah, I agree with you about that, Michael. I mean, and, since we've been doing this, I think we've been able to identify, like you say, these overarching themes. And if memory serves, in each season, we usually identify maybe one, two, or three of them.
Yeah.
Right. And it's interesting to take a single theme like that and explore it in different ways, in different subplots, with different characters.
Multidimensionally, you might say, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's what the decision has been, certainly about this, based on the evidence of Jinal, this episode, this time around. I think that that's probably the creative decision that was made about themes for this story arc.
I do think, though, we'll see where they take this. I mean, we have this interesting similarity, I think, between Gray's discussion with Adira about their relationship and discussions that Saru and Tarina have had about their relationship.
And Burnham and Book, too.
And Burnham and Book, actually, yes. I mean, they find themselves connected, but they're redefining or trying to define the nature of that connection.
And Rayner is trying to do the same thing, and Tilly's trying to push him to do the same thing. They are coming at it this many different ways just in this one episode alone, and not to mention, these are seeds that are planted that will continue for a few, if not all, of the rest of the episodes.
You know, I'd be surprised if they didn't. The thing I had in mind was, in this episode, Gray tells Adira that he wouldn't expect them to accept a transfer for him, right? And I think Tarina told Saru that back in Red Directive, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you know, don't accept this new position as ambassador for me. And maybe that's a direction they're going in here, you know, is with these connections, which is, as Gray said in this, you know, at the end of this episode, which evolve and change. It's something about how should those connections evolve and change. I mean, connections are great, but people change, they change.
And how do we negotiate this changing landscape, you might say, yeah.
Yeah, so there's that, and there's also this thing about purpose and meaning. And there was a connection here with connections in Gray's speech there at the end that, you know, he said that, you know, as we navigate these connections in this journey of life, that is how we find meaning. And of course, this meaning or purpose is something now that Burnham is looking for, that I suppose Culber is looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's going to be a big theme for this season. Purpose and meaning. And we may already have pointed that out before, but it's connected to the question of connections as well. These things are interrelated. It'll be interesting mm-hmm. to see what happens with them.
Indeed.
Well, looks like that about does it for this time, and we thank you for joining us today. We're going to be back for episode 4 of Discovery's final season, entitled Face the Strange, in our next podcast. You can watch for our podcast updates on Mastodon, Twitter, and Facebook at Trek_Academy, and on Tumblr at Trek Academy without the underscore. You can search online for the Star Trek Academy podcast and look for our red Vulcan hand salute logo. Also, don't forget to subscribe via your podcast app to automatically get the new podcast downloads. We thank you for being here, and we'll see you next time on the Star Trek Academy podcast.